Hello, 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 and welcome out there in podcast land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, a podcast about horror, science fiction, references, influences, and certain key elements. My name is David. I'm here with my good friend Tim. Hey, Tim, how are you?
Hey, David, I'm doing great. What's going on out there in the world of the sci-fi genre?
The sci-fi genre has actually had a really cool new addition recently, which I have been watching and suggest to everyone. It's called Upload. It's actually a sci-fi comedy, so to speak, and it is it's on Netflix. It's actually on Prime. Sorry, it is on Amazon Prime. Plug for them, and. It kind of combines a lot of Westworld and The Office, and it's done by the same producer that did The Office. And basically it takes place in a future around 2035 or 2040 when you can, before you die, you can upload your entire consciousness to like a server.
And that's you like can that Black Mirror episode.
Yes, yeah, it's like a comedy version of San Junipero. So yeah, but I highly recommend you might want to watch it. I think you'd like it. Give it a couple of episodes. It takes it's like most of them. It takes two. It's only half hour long, each episode. Mm-hmm. But it takes a couple of episodes to really get into it and realize their kind of style that they're doing, which is good. It's got some great stuff, to great concepts that are very believable to me in science fiction. If we did have something like that, it would become monetized, and there's lots of corporation ribbing in it. It's kind of like they combine weird corporations that have bought out other corporations, like Taco Bell, Intel. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I would like a chalupa.
So. Yeah.
I have crunchy a chalupa gordita with some offsite storage space on the side.
There you go.
Well, you brought up two things. Well, you triggered two things that I want to ask you just in this little blip. One is, how's Westworld going? Because I know you're watching it.
Mm-hmm. I finished it. Yeah.
Okay. I was just curious. I didn't realize it was done.
I would.
Okay. Sorry.
Well, Westworld set the bar really, really high with that first season, which was
brilliant. I know, and I've not seen anything since it. I didn't see the second season.
The second season is one of those where you have to watch the entire season to understand the puzzle box. They wrote it in a way so all it's kind of like, reading an Agatha Christie novel where she introduces a new character in the last two chapters. And you suddenly go, oh, okay, now I see what that was.
Okay.
So you have to watch, you can't like watch three episodes and go, oh, I hate the new season. So you have to watch all of season two in order to grasp it. And it does, it's a good complement to season one, but a totally different kind of style to it. And Nolan and Joy, the two creators, have both said they wanted every season to have a different style. Well, this season, the third season, is not a style I liked at all. It's basically action, adventure, lots of fighting, lots of struggle, not a lot of the inner psychology and, the existential questions that came from the first season. None of that's in this year. And the performances are still really strong, except for they added this character named Caleb, who is played by, cannot remember his name right now, but I'll insert it or whatever. No, the name, he was in Breaking Bad, which I still haven't seen either, by the way.
Oh my God.
But everybody supposedly has.
Yeah, that's a good show.
I've heard good things about it, but I've never seen anything of it. And evidently he's one of the characters in it that everybody liked, but he is absolutely terrible. throughout this entire series. And
I know who you're talking. You're talking about the kid. You're talking about the kid that plays Jesse. I call him a kid. He started on the first thing I ever saw him in. I cannot think of his name. Was the remake of Last House on the Left. He was He was, and I call him a kid because he was practically a kid in that. But then he was great as Jesse. Yeah, he's great as Jesse because he is like a punk, and he plays that very well. So but well, I forgot he's on Westworld this season.
Yeah, he's like the lead essentially in this one, and he is. His name is Aaron Paul, I think. Aaron Paul, that's his name.
It is Aaron Paul. You're right. Finally
got it. He's terrible. I'm sorry. I do not like his acting style. I do not like him. I didn't like his character arc. I didn't like literally anything about him. And that really disappointed me. And by the end of the episode, by the end of the series, I kept thinking, okay, so maybe this is like season two. I need to watch through the very end and then it'll all make sense. Well, it did, but it just made bad sense. And it was very, very disappointing. So there you go. That's my Westworld.
Sorry. I didn't mean to. I took something from your list.
No, not at all. No.
And then the other thing I was going to bring up is you said from the creators of The Office on that Upload show. Have you seen that the creators of The Office have a movie coming out called Space Force?
Yes, I did see that.
Okay. Yep. I saw a little blip on it yesterday, and I was like, I'm not a big Steve Carell fan, but I'm already thinking the concept's pretty funny.
Well, see, I'm weird because, and I'm ostracized by friends and everything because I don't like The Office. I can't watch that
Either. I don't like it. I don't like Steve Carell.
I do like Steve Carell. I don't mind him. Like, I liked him in 40-Year-Old Virgin and a couple of his other movies I've liked him in. So he might be okay. And I really liked him in the two dramas he's done. He's been really, really good in those. But I can't handle that forced embarrassment, do the interviews on the side, look straight at the camera, break the fourth wall comedy. It just doesn't work for me. So I'll be curious to see, because I do think the idea is humorous, but it's almost like it's a parody of truth kind of thing, you know? So
right, that's what I was getting at. Is, I mean, we just heard that word thrown about by the president not too long ago, and now there's already a movie, you know, and I'm like, okay, let's see what this is going to be.
Right. Yeah. Totally agree. But what about you? So I've been uploading. What have you been doing?
Well, I have been catching up on some films that I had not seen. And last season when we did The Wicker Man, I did a lot of research on what I would call pagan horror, but a lot of people call folk horror. And I found some movies, three in particular, that I think I added to our master list for future seasons. And I decided to indulge in one that was highly rated, and it's called The Apostle. I don't know if you've seen it. It's directed by It's directed by a guy named Gareth Evans. I don't know him. He did like a sequel to the VHS series, which I have not seen. But I kept hearing strong things about this. It's got Dan Stevens in it from Legion and Downton Abbey. He's a good actor. It's got Michael Sheen. I mean, the cast is really, really strong in this movie. A lot of British folks. And it's about a guy that goes undercover. It's a period piece set in 1905. Goes on undercover to find his sister to this island where these people have started their own little life and colony or whatever. And
with Rowan Morrison.
No, it's not Rowan Morrison at all. It goes way into crazy land with like Cronenberg type stuff. I mean, it is wild and very visually appealing and gory and terrifying, and I mean it's got everything in it. So I would definitely recommend it. I can see why people like it. It's not like anything you've ever seen, and don't confuse it with that Apostle movie that's got what's his face,
Anthony Hopkins.
No, the one with Robert Duvall, because that's an old. It's called The Apostle 2. It's not the same movie. This is definitely a horror movie. So
okay,
yeah, I would definitely recommend it.
So enter it, The Apostle. When did it come out?
2018.
Okay.
Yeah, and well, I won't get into the others, but there are some others out there I'm curious about too that fall kind of in that same genre that we were talking about that The Wicker Man and Midsommar came out of. So.
Hmm.
Anyway, we're still in horror territory this week because.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, we're gonna visit a little gem of a movie that came out in 1992. It's really hard to believe this movie is almost 30 years old. We're talking about Candyman, directed by Bernard Rose.
Mm-hmm.
I did not know. Bernard Rose is pretty much, I think, an indie director. Back when I watched Candyman for the first time, I tried to find other stuff he had done. And I did watch one called Paper House, which I may have put on our list too, because I do remember really liking it and being a little creeped out by it.
Yeah, I've heard great things about it. I've never seen it, but I've heard really good things about that particular movie. Yeah. He also wrote this too. So he wrote and directed it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Candyman is set in modern day. It's filmed actually in and around Cabrini Green, which is a very reputable neighborhood for a bad reputable neighborhood for crime and violence. It has since been renovated. I don't think any of that's there anymore. But at the time, there was a big anathema with the location of the film as well as the setting. And it is about some grad students that start investigating some superstitions they hear that have originated in this area and stumble upon several urban legends and are quite surprised to find out that some of them are true.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the first time you saw this movie?
Trying to remember the first time I saw it. I don't think I saw it in a theater. So I think I saw it on video when it was released. I remember liking it then. I thought it was a pretty cool movie, but I could definitely feel the Clive Barker influence
right
in it, because supposedly it's based on a Clive Barker story. But I guess the elements that reminded me of Barker were, you know, a hook and beads together is just a weird combo. So that's very Clive Barker to me, kind of thing. I did like I remember a few years ago, because Cabrini Green has been demolished and it's basically nothing right now. It's great big vacant lots in Chicago. But I remember visiting Chicago once and going out of my way, having the Uber driver actually take me out of the way so I could go by Cabrini Green through over the, you know, and look at it at least. And the only reason I did was because I remembered it from this movie. Definitely the location is an important part of it. But I think I saw it on video, may have even been with you. I don't remember really, but I do remember liking it and liking not only Virginia Madsen in it, but just the overall story and the feel and a very intellectual style horror movie kind of thing. What about you? Did you see it in the theater?
I did not see it in a theater. I was looking through my notes. I thought I had it. I can't find it though. If I come across it, I'll bring it up. But the last building of the Cabrini Green was demolished almost a decade ago. So yeah, it's been gone for a little while. If I saw it in a movie theater, I was living in a small South Georgia town at the time. I don't think I did, but if I did, I don't remember. I definitely remember watching it on video. You're correct in that it is based on a Clive Barker short story called The Forbidden. However, you can credit Bernard Rose, which is ironic because he's British, but he's the one that Americanized it. He's the one that turned Candyman into an African-American, set it in Chicago, made all the urban legend stuff transferred from the story. But everything else about this movie was really all Bernard Rose with Barker's backstory, which was set in Liverpool and involved white people. But I think he did a splendid job at it. I mean, this movie to me is so visually appealing and so memorable and such, like you said, a part of the world of Clive Barker that it's hard to think that he didn't actually write it this way to me. So anyway, I felt that way ever since I saw the movie. It's been a long time since I saw the movie, and when I sat down and watched it the other night, I was happy to find that this movie's still great. But there's a lot of people that smoke in it. I've never seen so many cigarettes in my life. I was laughing. I was like, oh my God, people smoked a lot back then. Every scene, well,
that's
man.
That's a trivia. That's definitely a good trivia point.
It stars Virginia Madsen. A lot of people out there may not know who that is. The main reason I know who that is because I was an intense moonlighting fan of the mid-80s with Cybill Shepherd and Bruce Willis. And Virginia Madsen became David Addison's love interest during the whole squabbles with Cybill Shepherd when she was trying to leave the show, and she was great on the show, so I knew her from that. I've got other casting notes that we'll get to later concerning her though, and then of course
I always liked her. She was always really good in everything I saw her in.
Yeah, absolutely. And then of course Tony Todd plays Candyman. Strong actor. Especially physically, his physical presence is very strong. He doesn't have a lot of dialogue in this film.
Voice is great.
The only thing I knew him from was that he played Ben in the 1990 remake of Night of the Living Dead, which neither one of us are that crazy about. And then wasn't he a Klingon in Next Generation? I think he was.
He was.
Yeah,
he was. He was actually Worf's brother. That's some science fiction geekery there, buddy. But he was actually Worf's brother, and he was in the film version of the play. And I think I've mentioned the play a couple of times on the podcast called Man from Earth, which is a really cool movie based on a play that was written by. What's his name? The sci-fi author, Jerome Bixby, who we've mentioned before. And Tony Todd plays one of the characters in that movie. And it's a really great movie. So I highly recommend it. He's got a great voice.
He's got an awesome voice. He's one of those, he's iconic for being African-American and in the horror genre. He's right up there with Ken Forhey from Dawn of the Dead. And both of them have great voices. And they're both large men. What's that?
Just what I was just about to say was that Ken Voorhees from Dawn of the Dead, they're like separated at birth to me.
Right.
Both of them are really good.
Yeah. And if you want to have a lot of fun, go to Shudder and watch something called Film Noir or Black Film Noir. I can't remember what the exact title is, but it's about the African-American presence in horror over the decades, and it's got African-American actors sitting in the theater, maybe two at a time, not all together, and their commentary. and it's got Keith David from The Thing. It's got Ken Voorhees. It's got Tony Todd. It's got I can't think of that female writer that Tanarive Dew is her name, or Tanarive Dew. She's in it, mm-hmm. and it's all about. I think it won awards. I'm not sure, but it's a great documentary on the African American in the horror genre. And they, it's fun seeing Ken Voorhees and Tony Todd or whoever it is he's with, Keith David, talking about these movies. It's great.
Well, Candyman is the only black villain, right? Or African-American villain, right? Ever on film? Because I can't remember another one that I've thought of. I mean, as far as horror movies go, I mean, there's been lots of,
I can't think of anyone prominent. I'm sure there's probably something in the periphery, but I don't know of anything prominent. It's kind of like, you know, back when they said there can be no gay villains. They don't want to be portrayed as villains, and they all freaked out when Silence of the Lamb comes out. I'm like, come on.
Mm-hmm.
Gay people kill people, mm-hmm. too. So, yeah. I mean, that's exactly what I said in our podcast episode, is gay people can kill people, too. Yeah.
I remember. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not going to.
Well, we could probably segue over to casting then, because we're talking about it so much.
Let me just say a couple more things in the background. The movie was budgeted mm-hmm. at $6 million. It opened at $5.5 million. It grossed $25.7 million in the USA. And for some reason, I have the worldwide as the same. And I know this movie was not just released in America, so I think that was a typo on IMDb.
Could be.
I mentioned earlier that a lot of the exteriors were actually filmed in Cabrini Green. Cabrini Green, actually, the Here of the Years right here, from 1942 to 2011. So the last building was torn down in 2011. Mm-hmm. They had a lot of real gang members as extras in this film and had to negotiate with some of these gang members for safety to film in these neighborhoods. That's why there's gang members in the movie. And apparently there was one day of danger where they got shot at and it went through the windshield of a car, but no one was hurt.
Interesting.
Yeah. So Bernard Rose, I saw something where he said, if you're going to do a scary movie, the place needs to be a scary place. And he said, there is palpable fear when you are in this place. And I can imagine. I would have been terrified.
I can imagine too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. No. I'm a little white boy. No, I would not go in there. That would not be a good thing.
Right. No. Right. So if you want to move on to casting, we mentioned that the lead is Helen Lyle, is the character name. She's played by Virginia Madsen. Originally, before, and this all happened probably in the changing of the locale from London or Liverpool to Chicago, but at one point, Bernard Rose's wife, Alexander Pig, was going to play Helen, but she decided, what happened was she got pregnant, and Virginia Madsen was going to play Bernadette's role. So when she got pregnant, she decided to let Virginia Madsen step into the lead role. And then when it got moved to Chicago, they felt that Bernadette would be better cast as an African-American woman. So all of that changed. But at one point, his wife was going to play the part. And I looked her up. She's not that well known, but I did look her up. But I do have one interesting note. Had Virginia Madsen not been available, an unknown was going to be cast in that part. And you know who it was?
Who?
Sandra Bullock.
Ooh. I could see that. That would have been interesting, too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because that would have been a good choice. It was about 2 years before Speed came out. So no one knew who she was. She had done films, but no one really knew who she was. So.
Well, and Virginia's brother is Michael Madsen, who's the big Tarantino guy, too. He's always in the Tarantino movies.
Yeah.
So
I mean, I didn't realize that.
From actors.
Okay. I like him a lot, and I never put that together, but that's cool. Candyman. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I thought you had more to add. Candyman slash Daniel, and I may be pronouncing this wrong. Is it Robitaille? Robitaille? It's Cajun or French because I believe he was from down south. His cat. Anyway, Tony Todd plays the part of Candyman. I'll just say Daniel R because I can't pronounce it. The only other person considered for this role, and you should be able to guess this. It'll make you mad.
No, I don't know.
Eddie Murphy.
Wesley Snipes. What?
Eddie Murphy.
No,
Yeah.
no, no.
You know why he didn't get it?
Don't you
Because
suck at it?
he was too short. They wanted him to be tall. So, good thing there for Tony Todd.
Oh, he would not have been good. No. No.
Trevor Lyle. This is Helen Lyle's shitty husband.
Oh, God. Yes. Yeah. Who
He
always
is.
plays that character, by the way? He
he
always plays
does.
that style.
I fucking hate him. His name is Xander Berkeley, and he got cast as Gregory on The Walking Dead, and Gregory is the same role. He is a shit you want to hit in the face. I mean, you just can't stand him. And he, I
Oh,
guess
see,
that's.
and
I was gonna
I
say
didn't
it's an
know that.
attest
I
to his
knew him
acting.
from, I guess so. I mean, I knew him from 24 and CSI, and in both of those, his characters are dicks. He just always plays a dick all the
Well, and he was in Terminator 2, the one we did last season. He's the one that gets impaled through the milk carton.
Yeah, he gets a pick in the face kind of
Yeah.
thing and deserves it. Yeah,
Right.
yeah.
But I mean, and it may
I
be
mean,
an
he's got a great.
attest. I mean, it could be an attestment to his acting that he's that good, but he always plays shit characters that I hate. So I always attribute it to him, and I hate him.
Well, and he always has. I mean, he has a great resume, though. I mean, he's in a bunch of stuff.
For
I
a
mean,
long
dozens and
time.
dozens of movies, yeah, and television, everything. So, yeah. Yeah, he's a good character actor, I would think, because just like what you said, he does such a good job playing the dick that we all hate him.
Right. For sure.
Yeah.
Bernadette, Bernie, known to her friends, Walsh, was Cassie Lemons. Are
Yes.
you, and you know who she is.
Well, I recognized her immediately. As soon as I saw her, it clicked, and I was going, wait. I've seen her. I've seen her. I've seen her. And like by the third line of dialogue, I had to pause it and went, okay, wait, what is it? What is it? Oh, she's Clarice Starling's best friend.
Yeah.
And that's how I recognized her. I remembered her
It's
immediately. Yeah.
almost, I was going to say you could actually classify it as a key because she has played like the best friend slash roommate of two iconic heroines in two
Yeah.
iconic horror films.
Yes, that's true. Yep.
So anyway.
And she was good. I wish she had had a little bit, her character-wise, story-wise, I wish there had been just a little bit more with
Yeah.
her because she was really good. And it was really powerful when she died. It was
Right.
good scare.
And
So,
she
yeah.
smokes too.
Yeah, they all do. Yeah, they do.
Anna Marie McCoy is played by Vanessa Williams, not the
That's
Vanessa
the
Williams.
baby's mama.
It
Is
is.
that
It's the
it?
mother of the
Okay.
child that is abducted by Candyman.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how to phrase this. Depending on when this episode airs, I'm not sure if the remake of Candyman will have been released by then or not. But
Right.
I peeked at the cast list of the new Candyman, and Vanessa Williams is back. And the main
Really?
character is that baby grown up. So those two people
Ah,
are in it.
okay.
And we also know Jordan Peele's behind this production. So I'm looking for some good stuff here because he's digging into cast members from the original and characters from the original. So, other than the main
Well,
character.
and he's so it's not a remake as much as it is a sequel.
Maybe.
It's going to be a sequel to Candyman.
Well, and I also saw that Helen Lyle is in it as well, but she is played by someone other than Madsen. So I'm wondering if it's like a flashback or a dream sequence or something. I don't know.
Maybe.
But I did. Yeah. So I did notice that. And then the other people.
I'm just saying you can't have a lead who's the baby in the first one if it's not a sequel. You know, it can't be a remake if he's a baby or was a baby.
Oh, you know, yeah, you're right. It could be a reboot, I guess. But yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Which I guess it would be. Actually, the only two other members of the cast that I feel are worth mentioning, I don't have like other auditioners or anything, is Jake, which was the little kid. His name's DeJuan Guy. He got nicknamed as One Take Jake. That's how good he was. I thought that was cute.
Mm. Okay.
He was the little kid that took her into the bathroom where she got attacked by the gang members.
Yeah.
He didn't do it intentionally, but it happened. And then, of course, Billy is played by Ted Raimi.
Ted Raimi, Sam's brother.
Right. I was like, holy shit, man, that's too cool. There's a lot of genre connection to this film. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That is
all
I have.
He's the only weird casting one I had. So, yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah. I did want to mention what I would call an honorary cast member in this film, and that is the music. I think the music is pretty well done in this film. It's very non-genre specific. It does not sound like horror movie music in most places. It sounds like classical music. It was composed by Philip Glass, who has been doing a lot of music for a very long time. But when he found out that the movie turned out to be what he considers a slasher, he kind of got pissed off. But he he's very happy that it's highly regarded, and he's still cashing the check, he says. Which I was like, dork.
He has done a lot of highbrow stuff. I remember him from, you know, and this may trigger you. You may remember this. There was a movie that we rented a lot on videotape, Koyaanisqatsi, which was basically just a visual movie, no dialogue to it, no real story. It was just it was MTV before there was MTV. Philip Glass did all the music for that. Very
and
trippy
what's it
movie,
called?
Very crazy. It's called Koyaanisqatsi, which
I don't
is a Native
that.
American word. Native American word. Yeah, you should look it up. I think if you saw it, it would bring back memories because I know you've seen it. But all of the music in it was done by Philip Glass, who always records electronically. And that's why I've got in my notes, when this movie first started, I was going, ooh, I don't really like the music. But then it started to grow on me a lot more. And I really like the gothicness of it. And I like using the little harpsichord sound. It worked really well and kind of elevate. I agree with you. I think it should be. It elevated the movie beyond a normal slasher.
Right.
More so than even the script does.
It does.
So, yeah.
And I don't know Philip Glass off the top of my head, but I did I do remember him being of some electronic composer, because as soon as I saw his name, I confused him with Giorgio Moroder, because I thought, is that the guy that did Cat People? And then I was like, no, that was Giorgio Moroder, who is also an electronic composer. You know, he did all the like Donna Summer dance music and stuff, as well as film.
Right.
But I knew I'd heard of Philip Glass. That name rang a bell. So anyway, that, yeah, I think that's a strong part.
He's done dozens of movies, but all very, they're all very electronic sounding. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a bend. He's like a post, you know, he's like a late 20th century Vangelis kind of.
Yeah. And I think either he, it may have been him or it may have been Giorgio Moroder did a re-edit of Metropolis with that music and like they put some rock music in it too. They like just added a bunch of new stuff to it and like re-released it or something. I remember. Nice. I can't remember which one it was because like I said, I confused the two, but it was one of them. So.
Yeah. Well, I think a few may have been the very end of last season. I mentioned Tales from the Loop, which is a new show that's on Netflix. He does all the music for it. Philip Glass does. So,
oh, cool.
He's still doing, still working, mm-hmm. sort of thing.
And still cashing that check.
I totally agree with you. Yeah, cashing that check. So what about, I mean, favorite scenes, favorite, are you two, wait, is that all casting?
That is cast. I was going to move to scenes next, for sure.
Sure.
I don't have a lot written down as scenes. I do, I have some in my head. The only thing I have written down is bees, practical effects.
Yes,
lots
they
of bees,
are.
Yep. Lots of practical effects. So.
And Virginia Madsen is allergic to bee stings. So. Mm-hmm. I knew that.
And Tony
too.
Todd negotiated money for every bee sting, too.
There you go.
he negotiated $1,000 a bee sting, and he was stung 25 times.
Wow.
And literally had them in his mouth. They put a dental dam.
That was practical.
Yeah.
They really
to keep
did
him from going down his throat. That's some fucking loyalty, man.
That's some dedication to the craft right there. Yeah. That's like, you know, Steve Roe losing an eyebrow. You know, that's what it
Or breaking his arm. Didn't he
or
break
breaking
his
arm?
Arm.
Yeah.
For all you folks out there, this is a friend of ours that jumped off a roof while David was filming and the film ran out and he broke his arm.
For no reason, because
no
we
reason.
Lost the film. So, no film.
I was going to say the first,
go ahead.
To me, the opening shot sets the tone of the movie. It's a beautiful shot. It's the widest aerial shot I can recall in any film I've ever seen.
Yeah, it reminded me of a drone shot, and they didn't have drones back then.
Right.
So it was a really cool shot to begin. Mm-hmm. And he does that a few times. He does it like when they keep cutting back to the university, a couple of times with Cabrini. He does these very aerial, the city is alive kind of shots, which is cool.
Mm-hmm.
I do think the direction is very strong all the way through this. I think the writing is good all the way through this. I really like the intellectual approach to the story and some of the cool stuff he did. One of the key scenes in this to me that I just love the whole way it was done was all of them sitting around. It was obviously a bunch of college professors and their significant others sitting around the bar talking, and the guy actually tells the story of Candyman,
right.
And didn't know until I saw the credits at the end that the guy telling the story is the director. That was him doing that story. But the way he tells it, and with the, as he's saying it, we're just hearing the sound effects of mm-hmm. Candyman being tortured and the bees and all that. It was just really well done the way he did it, and creepy sounding. It was like a campfire story in an urban setting, which I thought was, you know, kind of cool if you're telling an urban legend story kind of thing.
Right. And you mentioned intellectual, and I was going to say and intellectual snobbery, because he's a total prick. And he's like saying, yeah, I know all about it. This is the story. You're not on to anything
mm-hmm.
new. He's just a total douche.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's a good way of revealing that exposition that's needed. So.
Yeah. And I didn't feel manipulated in it at all. I didn't feel like the murders or anything were like unavoidable or, you know, that kind of stupid thing where you, I mean, I started to when she picked up the meat cleaver and I went, don't pick up, no, what, no, don't pick up a weapon. But then I would think, wait, if there was blood all over me and the dead dog, I would probably grab the nearest weapon and take it with me. So that made sense. The only thing I think plot-wise that disturbed me or bothered me was the scene in the bathroom, because I just didn't find it realistic that an entire gang would hit her a couple of times, knock her out, and leave.
Yeah.
I think, it would have been a lot worse.
if she was alive, she would have been raped. She would have. I mean, her eye was pretty fucked up, but I think she would have looked worse. Yeah.
That was the only thing that really threw me. That and, you know, because the mysticism you give into, yes, Candyman can somehow, you know, put a baby inside the bonfire, you know, or whatever. So,
or he puts her in the position of the dog murderer. Like they flip positions to where all of a sudden she looks like she's guilty. So that's kind of a stretch too. But I mean, I buy it totally.
Yeah, but it was a very, you know, Hitchcockian, and that was one of my keys to it. It's a very Hitchcock thing where now suddenly the hero of the movie is trying to prove their innocence kind of thing. And that was really compelling. I liked that. I liked her going, you know, and then you start rooting for her going, no, don't tell the cop that. No, don't say, no, don't, you're going to, no.
I know. So, I mean, you feel so bad for her. And then she's got a shitty husband to boot.
Yeah. Yeah, which was good too, because you kind of thought, oh, is vengeance going to come here? Is this going to be, is she going to have to murder in order to become his bride or something? I didn't know where it was going. So that was really good. I really liked that. I thought the direction was good all the way through. It's really slow paced in places. So I think modern audiences, you know, might be thinking, oh, wow, this is slow. But it works for me. I thought it worked really well. I did think it was overlit in places. There were other places where the lighting was great. Like when they were in Cabrini Green, all that lighting was awesome. Mm-hmm. But anytime they were in an interior set, like that wasn't the bonfire or wasn't the lair, like when they were in the apartments or the police station, everything is so brightly overlit, almost like television.
When you say that, the scene I think immediately of is his appearance in the car deck, the parking deck. That's his first appearance. I mean, it's so saturated that you almost just see his silhouette. But I thought that might be intentional.
Oh, I agree. I think that was intentional. I didn't mind that at all.
Okay.
But I didn't like the scenes where she's looking at the slides, or the scenes when she's in the apartment, or the scene when, you know, she confronts her husband at the end in the stupid co-ed. All of that is so overly lit.
The pink walls. Ugh.
Yeah. I hate
the color.
She said.
Yeah. I hate your color palette. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. But I really, you know, one of the keys I said it was Hitchcock. You know, this is a very Hitchcock, Brian De Palma kind of feel, where you've got a blonde heroine falsely accused. She's trying to solve the mystery and then she's drawn into this plot.
David, really cool. You're onto something there. There's more Hitchcockian to it than that. I mean, even that first shot that I mentioned is like right out of Rope or a De Palma movie. That slow pan that just keeps going and going. And I was like, wow, this is beautiful. But I never really thought about it. You're right. It's very Hitchcockian.
Even the first shot of Psycho, you know, is that big pan over the city before it zooms in on the window.
Exactly. With them. Exactly.
So it's that kind of feel. Yeah. And even down to the, you know, that kind of, that ending you don't expect kind of thing. You don't, you're rooting, you know, I like the fact that this movie ends with the, in an unexpected way.
It's not, yeah, really it's cool. Not your typical ending at all.
No.
Even though they still do give you a little bit of a jump scare at the end, which is kind of tropey, but it's definitely a unique ending.
I liked the, him hovering over her when she's in the straight. Or in
Isn't
the
that
straight.
Awesome? Yeah.
That was
like,
awesome.
Wow.
That was
Who
great.
Thinks of that? I mean, that was just so bizarre.
Yeah. I'm just looking back at my notes to see what highlights I've got in it. I thought the baby was murdered at first, which was really cool the way he did that, the way the mother reacted and everything else. So I thought the baby had been killed as well.
Right. So and it was nice the dog. Work. Yeah.
Yeah. I do have, I think there's also a real kind of pull. There's a great chemistry between Tony Todd and Virginia Madsen. So there was a great chemistry between those two characters when they were together. And it was a very vampire-like key to me.
Did you know, this kind
of come with me and live forever thing sort of,
right.
sort of deal?
Exactly. Very interview. Did you read the fact that he was hypnotizing her at one point? I thought that was odd. And she didn't like it, and she made him stop. But Bernard Rose was hypnotizing her before her scenes with Todd so that she would look dazed. And she had, like, a keyword that he would use to, like, knock her off somehow. I thought that was very strange.
Yeah.
And she so finally said it was too much, and she said, we can't do this anymore. I'll just act.
So interesting that you said that, because you were saying that and I was looking at my notes, and my notes has, and this director for some reason really likes boobs.
Yeah.
Because there's like, even the co-ed at the end with no bra and everything else.
Right. And going, then when okay, she's in the bathtub and hers are floating and for sure.
Yeah. So maybe that was part of the hypnosis that kind of helped. I do like...
Oh, my God. Me too. Me too.
Me too. I do like the Cree...
That's not good. Like, of course, it was 30 years ago.
Yeah, there was no Me Too back then, of course.
No. Well, there was. It just wasn't apparent. People didn't make it notice.
I do like... I did want to say that I like the whole... believing in a myth gives it power. Kind of underlay to this. I mean, even he taps on that premise like three or four times. And at the very end, you find out that it's real, because by believing in Helen and the Candyman and everything else, it gave the legend all this more power. And that's interesting, because even I think that, you know, the snotty director guy says it, Trevor, her husband, says it at one point. You know, I think even Bernadette says it to her about, you can't believe in this kind of thing. You'll scare yourself kind of stuff. And so I thought that was a cool concept that he threaded all the way through it, this kind of strengthening a myth by even believing in it sort of thing.
Well, and then she becomes totally susceptible and immersed in it because she has no one to turn to. So that's the only thing she's got.
Oh, yeah.
Is the myth. And so she just basically becomes it, a part of it anyway. Yeah, it's great. And that's what I talk about Barker. That's a Barker concept. I mean, he thinks big concepts in his words, and that's exactly where that came from.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see if what Jordan Peele will do with that, if he'll play that up a little bit or whatever, because he's a good choice for this remake or reboot or whatever.
I mentioned earlier that we were uncertain of its release date and where we fall as far as this airing, but it's because, you know, COVID-19 has delayed a lot of stuff, so we're not really sure when Candyman will be out. But I will say that if it's good, it may be on next season's list, because I'm very curious to see what he does with it.
Well, and I was looking, you know, in research, it said that... Rose, the writer-director, had also written the screenplay for the new one. So it'll be interesting to see. I thought that would be interesting.
You mean the one that Peele's doing?
Yeah.
And he's using it?
Yeah. Yeah. The remake script was written by Rose.
Wow. I did not know that. That's amazing. Yeah. That means so it must be pretty strong, I would think, or Peele would just have ditched it and done his own thing.
True. True. Hmm. So I'm curious to see that. What else about you? What about you? Any other scenes that stand out for you other than bees coming out of his mouth and whatever?
I love the iconic shot of her going through that wall, and it's the graffiti of the mouth. I think that's a really cool, iconic shot. The whole going into that medicine cabinet and what's behind it is very Barker-esque as well. Considering, to me,
the key there too was all of that going into something like Lion, Witch in the Wardrobe or Harry Potter or any of those when you're going beyond the walls into something secret.
That's a great key. I had not even thought about that because it's outside of the genre. But yeah, I get it. Totally.
Yeah. Although, the second time when she goes back and she's looking for the baby, this is before the bonfire and everything, and she goes back and she's looking for the baby, that is the biggest medicine cabinet in the world because she barely even has to bend over to crawl through the wall. You know, the first time when she's with Bernadette, she actually has to climb up on the sink and then...
Kind of sit down and scooch in. Yeah.
In the next shot, she barely just bends over and walks through. And I was going, what, did it get bigger? What happened?
I didn't catch that. That's funny.
Yeah.
But that scene, not really scenes are jumping at me right now. It's more the Barker stuff that's kind of jumping at me. And I'll sum up with that when we get toward the end. I can talk about a few awards if you like.
Yeah, that's perfect.
It was the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Award winner for Best Actress, and it was nominated for Film, Writing, and Makeup. So Virginia Madsen won an award for that part from that organization.
The makeup was really good.
Yeah. The character of Candyman came in at number 8 on Bloody Disgusting's top 13 slashers in horror movie history. And it was ranked on Yugo, whatever that is, top 11 slashers. And Tony Todd made number 53 on Retro Crush's 100 Greatest Horror Movie Performances for his role. So of that stuff, small press type stuff that I'm not familiar with. There is one thing I'm familiar with, David. Guess what list it's on?
1001?
Yeah, 1001 movies you must see before you die. So another that we have chosen has ended up on this list. And I would like to point out to people out there that we don't go by this list to choose these movies. I find out about it in retrospect, and it's kind of funny.
So. Yes, definitely. I think we need to let everybody know that we do not. We actually find out later. We're not using that as a source. So, yeah.
Right. But that's pretty much all of the award type stuff. I mentioned some trivia. I actually had it wrong. He was stung 23 times, not 25 times. So he made $23,000 because he had a good agent. And he's not seen for 44 minutes in the movie. So a lot of the magic of this movie is the legend and the myth that they build up before he even shows his face.
Right. To me, I find that much better. I mean, that's what makes Jaws work. That's, you know, I wish the Freddies and the Jasons and the Michael Myerses could learn from that, you know, that you can build up the suspense and it makes it even scarier sometimes. Yeah. But
that being said, I've not seen the sequels to this movie. Have you?
I have not. Is there more than one?
There's two.
There's actually more than one sequel? Really?
One's called A Farewell to the Flesh. And then there's another one. And both of them have Tony Todd. And for all I know, he is Freddy and Jason in those movies. You know, wisecracking and popping up everywhere. I don't know. I haven't seen them. So any of you gentle listeners out there, if you would like to inform us of your opinions of those films, feel free to.
Yeah, I didn't even research them at all. So that would have been interesting.
And they are keys, obviously, but we haven't seen them.
Yeah, so we can't comment on them. But, you know, they're out there.
Yeah. Should we move on to keys? Or are you
Sure, let's
in?
key a bit.
Think it's time that we could reach into that territory. Well, the first one that is blatant to me is William Shakespeare.
Oh yeah, sweets to the sweet. There you
Sweets to the
go.
Sweet, written right there at the crime scene, and also in that bathroom where she gets beat up. It's on the walls and on the stalls. Billy's
Yeah, I think it's
everywhere.
very it's his catchphrase. So
Right.
yeah, I definitely agree with that. I've got any urban legend movie that came out of this, including the movie Urban Legends and all of its sequels. But all the ones like, even like Babadook and Mothman, When a Stranger Calls, all those that are based on an urban legend, although this one I think does it so much better than any of those. Maybe because they're examining urban legends in general. I mean, Urban Legend tries to. I saw the first movie of that series and it was terrible.
Don't I had that key as well, and I also listed the Final Destination movies. Aren't those that way too? I think.
Although they're more the premonition, I've got a, I'm tempting death kind of thing, but it is an urban legend that you can do that. I mean, they actually created their own urban legend out of it. Of if you get that, if you're on an airplane and you think you're going to die, you should get off. Because, but even if you get off, you're still doomed. All your friends are going to die, or whatever. But
Right.
yeah.
I couldn't remember if those were urban legend based or not, but they remind me of those urban legend movies. Because there was a whole string of Urban Legend 1, 2, and 3, and there was a whole string of Final Destination, same 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah.
Yeah, and I remember, and I'm sure I can't remember the title, and I should have researched it, but there were at least one movie, if not two, I've seen that are based on, maybe they were Outer Limits or Twilight Zones episodes or something, but they're based on the Lover's Lane young couple, and they
Yes,
tell the
I've got
story
that
of the
as
guy with
well.
the hook.
Right.
And they drive off, and then later on they find the hook in the gas tank or whatever, or under the car, or, yeah, that sort of thing.
Well, I wrote that down as just two urban legends exist that this movie plays on. One is the Bloody Mary urban legend of chanting the
Oh,
name in
yeah.
front of the mirror so many times before something appears. And then the other is the killer with the hook for a hand. You know, the old story you hear about Lover's Lane and them finding a hook on the car door when they get home or whatever, that thing. Yeah, for sure.
Perfect. Yeah, we both had that one.
When
Definitely.
you mentioned urban legend movies, you said even Mothman, Stranger Calls, and what else?
Babadook.
Babadook. Okay.
Babadook, yeah.
Because I had not really considered those, but you're right, for sure.
Well, oh yeah. I just thought you remind me of another one. Black Christmas or Bad Santa or Deadly Santa or whatever. That whole thing of
Silent Night, Deadly Night.
the
And you haven't even seen Babadook, have you? And you know it's an urban legend, even if you haven't seen it.
But the whole, thing of the mental patient who's escapes and dresses up as Santa Claus.
Oh,
I
you're
remember
thinking
that
of
from
Tales
Tales from
from
the
the
Crypt.
Crypt. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God, we've got so many movies in our head. Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah. Yeah, I get strange looks all the time. You mentioned I'll mention this as a I'll mention this as a key. You had mentioned earlier there's a heavy like vampire-esque element where it's what I would call the romance of death. And this movie is a really unique pairing of those elements as far as romance and death. Because, you know, she's
Definitely.
basically seduced by Candyman. And I don't know, you just don't see it that often. And if you do, you don't see it well. Anne Rice does it beautifully. But this movie does as well.
Cool.
There's
I
another
think that's great. That's really
Shakespearean
good.
reference too, I just realized. When he says, "I will rip you from groin to gullet,"
Yeah.
That's a play on the line from Macbeth, from the knave to the chaps.
Knave to the chaps. Yep.
Yeah. So that reference is very Shakespearean as well. And then the only other keys I have.
I did not realize that one. That's good.
Mm-hmm. The other keys I have really are just Barker films in general. The ones that are really good. Hellraiser, comes to mind. Anything that can, Barker was such a unique, I say it like he's dead and he's not, but he was such a unique horror writer for going places that no one had ever gone. And
yeah.
Hellraiser is another where he just basically creates this whole new world. He does it in this film. There are a few other films that attempt it to lesser degree. Nightbreed being one. I kind of like Midnight Meat Train. Have you seen it with Brad? What's his face?
I've not seen the movie. I read the book.
On the subways. Yeah. That movie tries to capture it. And I guess this is what I'm getting to. And I think I probably wrote this down. If I didn't, it's what I was thinking. Is why aren't people doing more of his things? He's got 6 books of short stories. All that this came from, that Hellraiser came from, that Midnight Meat Train came from. Why aren't people doing his stuff?
Maybe because they're on the Stephen King roll right now. Maybe they'll get around to Barker next.
Yeah. I just think he's bloody original, and, a lot of Hollywood just doesn't do original. They want rehash.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's kind of the thing, but hopefully maybe with the rise of all the, the subscriber channels, the Netflix and Amazon Prime and all that, maybe that'll happen.
Yeah, hope so.
Because they do take risks, and they do different things.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the only last key I've got is kind of I stumbled upon it, and it's a personal key. And it's actually that Bernard Rose, the writer and director, and I both share a similar credit. I found out that he obviously was a production assistant or helped out on Army of Darkness, and he's listed in the credits as a fake chimp.
Oh, my God, that's hilarious.
Yeah, in Evil Dead.
Because did they film that at Pinewood? Didn't they film some of that at Pinewood?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that's why, because he's British. Okay. That's funny. Yep. Yeah. And so, you're a fake chimp from the original movie. You ought to write him and say, hey, we have something in common.
Hey, we do. We have something in common.
Well, and that explains why Ted Raimi's in it, too. It's because he knows.
I'm sure they know each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Wow, 6 degrees of separation. Oh, you know what? I just found a second page of notes, and I've got a couple of trivia things I left out that I can say.
Sure.
Clive Barker has confronted a number of academics who have accused him of taking advantage of and using an African-American urban legend with the simple fact that he created the story of Candyman. I think I read that wrong. But he has pointed out that he created the story of Candyman and that it was not based on an urban legend. And what's even funnier about that is it was not set in Chicago. It was set in Liverpool with a white man. But people come up and accuse him of this shit. And I think that's kind of funny.
Yeah, it's a very Mandela effect sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that Mandela effect where people believe something and it's totally false, but they swear that they've seen it or done it, like Sinbad playing a genie or whatever, kind of thing. That's interesting because, I can understand them coming up to him and saying, no, you stole, what do they call it? Ethnic appropriation, whatever. What's the big term for it now? Crap.
I don't know.
Like,
but I thought Sinbad did play a genie.
No, he didn't. Did he not? No.
Sinbad never played a genie? Really?
No. That's the Mandela effect.
My God. I have a Mandela effect. Like, I need another affliction.
Yeah.
What
was that? We looked at a bunch of them recently, like Berenstein Bears. It's not Berenstein. It's Berenstein Bears. You know, there's a bunch of them. There's like 40 or 50 out there that are all Mandelas. You know, Curious George doesn't have a tail, you know. So that kind of stuff.
Well, he's got shorts on. How would you know?
No, he doesn't have shorts on.
Oh, he doesn't?
He just wears a little, every now and then he wears a vest. But, you know, yeah.
The only other thing I have is that the change of the setting necessitated a change to certain elements of the film. The source of inspiration may have been a pair of articles that this guy wrote for the Chicago Reader in 1987 and 1990 about the murder of a woman named Ruthie Mae McCoy, which is, I think her name's McCoy in the movie, a resident of Chicago's Abbott Homes housing project. In 1987, McCoy had been killed by an intruder who entered her apartment through an opening behind the bathroom's medicine cabinet.
Really? Yeah, oh, I didn't know that.
It's fascinating. But I can see why he lifted that, because that's great.
Yeah, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the whole killer came out of the walls thing. That's pretty good. Yeah.
Right. The killer's in the house. Get out of the house.
Yeah. Get out. Too bad we can't stay, baby. Let's go. Yeah.
So. Yeah. But that pretty much wraps it up for what I have as far as keys and overall, even, because I was going to close with the fact that I do think people should look into Barker's material. There's a wealth of material out there that would make some really great imaginative horror films if people would just take a chance. And this was one of them.
Yeah. And I think in general, people should approach this movie. This falls into that intellectual horror movie category. It's a very smart movie. It's very well done. And we both recommend it. So
we do
get out there and watch it. So, unless you totally disagree with us, and then let us know anyway, you know. So we want to hear from you.
Yeah, we're lonely. Talk to us.
We're lonely. Talk to us. Let us know.
Say my name five times in front of a computer monitor.
Perfect.
Candyman.
There you go. They're David. Coming to get you, Candyman. So cool. So thanks so much for doing this with me again, Tim. We so appreciate it.
I enjoyed it.
Like we always say, we appreciate you guys listening to us. And we'll be back next time with a new movie and new insights and new keys.
Well, not necessarily new, but it will be a different movie.
A different one, yeah.
And maybe in the science fiction genre.
Maybe. You never know. So come back and see us. Yeah.
All right.
Talk to you then, my friend.
All right. Take care. Bye.